Hello, today is Thursday, February the 26th of 2026. My name is Kayla Verhoeven. Thank you for joining us today. We're going to start with the first start of the pantograph, and we're going to start out with Social Services for Logan, Mason, and Menard, A Bridge to a Better Life. Mental Social Help Offered After Police Encounter a Need by Drew Zimmerman, 2 hours ago. Social Services for Logan, Mason, Menard Counties. Lincoln. A coalition of police and social service agencies on Tuesday launched a new program to connect Logan, Mason, and Menard County residents for help for mental health, substance abuse, housing, and other issues. The Building Recovery, Inclusion, and Dignity for Growth and Empowerment, or BRIDGE, team held a public training session at Lincoln Park District to familiarize stakeholders with this deflection initiative. The program is designed to direct undeserved individuals who may have encounters with police to nearby support services before they become involved in the criminal justice system. The program is a collaboration between local law enforcement, mental health, and substance use service providers, and representatives of Treatment Alternatives for Safe Communities, a nonprofit that provides healthy recovery management services. Although TASC will not offer any additional programs, its specialties will ensure that residents can receive the help they need through a relentless engagement process. Unlike diversion programs, which are centered around the justice system and are primarily for high-risk and high-need offenders with arrest records, BRIDGE's deflection initiatives are community-centered and target low-risk individuals with no arrest records. Corinne Vanderweel, Senior Program Manager for TASC's Center for Health and Justice, said her organization has learned that you don't have to wait until someone is arrested to connect them to treatment services, safe housing, employment opportunities, and other services. It's on an average of 7 to 9 times that someone will have contact with a police officer before they're arrested, Vanderweel said. So leveraging those 7 to 9 different contacts and taking advantage of that and saying, let's get you connected to different treatment or different services, whatever it may be, so that hopefully you don't have more contact with law enforcement. Vanderweel added that there are 12 other multi-jurisdictional BRIDGE sites that offer deflection initiatives to about 56% of the state. A lot of our initiatives actually happen in more of rural Illinois, because we know that there is a great need because there are a lack of resources, Vanderweel said. There's a lack of transportation as well. The program is funded by the Illinois Department of Human Services through cannabis tax revenue. Vanderweel said the program just received a 3-year contract last year, so it will operate into 2028. Lincoln Police Chief Joe Meister said that if an officer encounters an individual who could benefit from substance abuse treatment, mental health services, or housing options, that person will be invited to fill out a referral form to the BRIDGE team. Once the form is received, a deflection specialist will start looking for that individual within 48 hours to help connect them to services tailored to their needs. This will begin a relentless engagement process to keep these individuals connected to services and resources that foster long-term public safety. He added that an individual's willingness to participate in this program is just as important as their eligibility, which is why specialists will provide their contact information even when people are initially unwilling to participate. I've heard specialists tell stories about how they've made contact with an individual who is in need but wasn't ready to seek the help they needed, Meister said. And a month later, after no contact at all, that individual reached back out and said, "Hey, I'm ready for help." Were it not for the BRIDGE program, officers may be forced to transport individuals in need of behavioral health services to Bloomington or Springfield, Meister said. However, larger communities that have treatment centers don't always provide 24-hour services, and officers may not be trained to offer the specialized case management services offered by the BRIDGE program. Meister said that several years ago, the Lincoln Police Department was involved in a program called Safe Passages, which was designed to have law enforcement connect people with substance use disorders to appropriate services. However, the responsibility to manage the program, arrange transportation, and manage funding fell almost entirely on the police department. And what we found was we were unable to meet the needs of our community, Meister said. But with the launch of this new deflection initiative, Meister expects his department's operations to improve, since residents in need of those essential services will be connected to people specifically trained to assist them. In other political news, speech partisan and patriotic sales job. Trump talks economy, Dems, tariffs, and Iran, by Stephen Sloan and Steve Peoples, 2 hours ago, Associated Press. State of Union analysis, Washington. President Donald Trump started in sales mode, using his State of the Union address to deliver an upbeat vision of the U.S. economy. But that portrayal collides with the sentiment of Americans, who remain anxious about their finances and feel they haven't benefited from Trump's policies. He took the high road to honor the gold medal-winning U.S. men's Olympic hockey team and a war hero before pivoting abruptly to a darker tone as he ridiculed Democrats. Here are some takeaways from the speech. Trump's roaring economy. Much of the nation is worried about the direction of the economy, but Trump says the good times are here, insisting repeatedly that rising costs are no longer a problem. The roaring economy is roaring like never before, he said. He cheered the lower cost of gasoline, mortgage rates, prescription drug prices, and the rising stock market. Millions and millions of Americans are all gaining. Such optimism, as so many Americans are feeling economic strains, risks painting Trump as out of touch. Just 39% of U.S. adults approved of Trump's handling of the economy in February, according to the APNORC polling. Still, the president focused much of the first hour of his speech on the economy, something Republicans had urged him to do as they head into the midterm elections. Trump and patriotism. For a president who always seems to be spoiling for a fight, Trump also tried to summon Americans' innate patriotic impulses. In addition to the hockey team, he singled out war heroes and those who had taken brave stands in other countries, using the moment to bestow numerous presidential medals in an effort to give the address a more positive gloss. It underscored the president's media savvy and understanding that even if a moment isn't appreciated completely in real time, it can have an afterlife in the days following the speech, especially on social media. In one revealing moment, Trump lamented why he couldn't give a congressional medal to himself, taking aim at Democrats. Tributes to the Olympic hockey team and a World War II veteran didn't unify the room for long. The Republican president soon took aim at Democrats and blamed them for many of the nation's ills. Trump said rising health care premiums are quote-unquote caused by you, suggested Democrats are quote-unquote not protecting Social Security, and blamed them for the nation's affordability crunch. You caused that problem. You caused that problem, Trump said as he glared at the Democratic side of the room. He seemed to get angrier as the speech progressed. These people are crazy, I'm telling you. They're crazy, he said. Democrats are destroying this country. High Court's unfortunate ruling. By Trump's standards, he held his tongue when it came to the Supreme Court. After the court struck down his tariff policy last week, Trump said the justices who voted against one of his signature issues were an embarrassment to their families. By Tuesday, he simply called the ruling unfortunate. Trump sought to treat the ruling with indifference, insisting that tariff revenues were saving the U.S., ignoring the fact that levies haven't made a significant dent in government debt. He said the tariffs were paid by foreign countries, even as virtually every study concludes that costs have been paid by U.S. firms and consumers. At one point, he seemed to take the long view that history would ultimately vindicate him, even if the Supreme Court would not. As time goes by, I believe the tariffs paid by foreign countries will, like in the past, substantially replace the modern-day system of income tax, taking a great burden off of the people that I love, he said. Trump claims election cheating. The president also used the speech to reprise his attack on the integrity of U.S. elections. Cheating is rampant in our elections, Trump said. Trump has made such claims for years, focused on his 2020 election loss, claims rejected by dozens of courts and his own attorney general at the time. Trump is calling on Congress to pass a bill requiring voters to show a photo ID before casting ballots. But he also recently vowed to enact an executive order to address the issue, although the White House has not clarified what it might entail. No mention of Minneapolis. Sometimes what's not said is as notable as what is. Trump has highlighted immigration since the very first speech in which he announced his 2016 presidential campaign. And on Tuesday night, he revived much of the same language he used throughout the past decade, blasting quote-unquote criminal aliens and warming of drug lords, murderers all over our country. What he didn't mention, the most aggressive immigration enforcement tactics that threatened to bring the U.S. to the brink earlier this year. He didn't mention the deaths of two U.S. citizens in Minneapolis last month at the hands of federal agents. Indeed, it was Representative Rashida Tlaib, Democrat from Michigan, who shouted that Alex wasn't a criminal, referring to Alex Priddy, one of the U.S. citizens killed in Minneapolis. During her Democratic rebuttal, Virginia Governor Abigail Spornberger said law enforcement must work to build trust in the communities, and said Trump, every minute spent sowing fear is a minute not investigating murders. Trump said nothing of his administration's shift in tactics, including a drawdown of agents in the Twin Cities, and he made no acknowledgement of the broad concerns in the U.S. about Trump's approach on immigration, as demonstrated by the 60% of U.S. adults who disapproved of his handling of the issue in February, according to AP NORC polling. Drumbeat for war gets louder. Trump has already built up the largest U.S. military presence in the Middle East in decades. And in his speech, he outlined a rationale for those who use forces to launch a major military strike against Iran. The president said that Iran and its proxies have spread nothing but terrorism, death, and hate, adding that its leaders killed at least 32,000 protesters in recent weeks, which is at the further end of estimates over the death toll. The U.S.-based human rights activist news agency has so far counted more than 7,000 dead and believes the death toll is far higher. Iran's government offered only death toll on January 21st, saying 3,117 people were killed. Trump also warned that the nation has developed missiles that can threaten Europe and is working on its missiles that will soon reach the U.S. My preference is to solve this problem through diplomacy. But one thing is certain, I will never allow the world's number one sponsor of terror, which they are, by far, to have a nuclear weapon. We just can't let that happen. In other government and politics news, a top story spotlight, three GOP candidates clash in the first televised debate for a chance to face Pritzker by Ben Solinsky, Capital News, Illinois, 20 hours ago. Three Republicans seeking the right to face Governor J.B. Pritzker in the fall met for the first time in a televised debate on Tuesday as they tried to muster momentum ahead of the March 17th primary. The debate gave DuPage County Sheriff James Mendrick, businessman Rick Heiner, and researcher Ted Dabrowski an opportunity to introduce themselves to voters outside the shadow of the party's 2022 nominee Darren Bailey, who declined to participate in the debate hosted by Fox 32 in Chicago. I've participated in four forums across the state, and my running mate Aaron Del Mar has taken part in three, Daley said in a statement to Capital News Illinois. Voters have had plenty of chances to hear from us, who we are, what we believe, and the direction we want to take Illinois. At this point, my focus is simple. Getting out across Illinois, meeting people where they are, listening to their concerns, and sharing our plan to move this state forward, Bailey said. A WGN/Emerson College poll in early January found that Bailey had support from 34% of likely Republican primary voters, while the three candidates at Tuesday's debate all polled under 10%. The candidates largely declined to take any free shots at Bailey, though Dabrowski's closing thought of the night was that Bailey should have participated, especially because the debate was held on a Chicago TV station in a market he struggled in 4 years ago. Problematic campaign contributions. Instead, Dabrowski and Heidner focus their attacks on each other. Heidner, a Barrington Hills real estate developer and video gambling mogul, has faced criticism since entering the race for ties to indicted politicians, people allegedly part of the mob, and campaign contributions to Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson and former Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox, both Democrats. "I've always worked on both sides," Heidner said. "I'll always be able to work with both sides. I am very well respected by Democrats and very well respected by the Republicans, and I think it's a huge asset." But Dabrowski saw those contributions differently, as Heidner described how he hoped the contributions to Johnson would help him in conversations about expanding gambling in the city. "That's what I would call, in a way, pay-to-play politics, which is you benefit from doing deals with Democrats, with Republicans," Dabrowski said. Heidner further bashed Dabrowski, telling the former WirePoints researcher, "You sit in front of a computer and hit Google, okay? Click, click, click." Dabrowski also faced heat about the conservative purity of contributions to his campaign. "He has received contributions from several people who has also donated to Democrats in recent years. He defended the individuals as Chicago executives or Chicago reformers rather than Democrats." "Let's pretend they're Democrats," Dabrowski said. "Man, if Democrats want to come over to me, everyone knows my conservative position. If they want to donate to me and come to my side, heck yeah. And if they're sick of Pritzker and if they're sick of Brandon Johnson, which they are, they're going to come to my side, which proves why I'm the campaign that can beat Pritzker." Mindrick had to defend his donors, but in a different way. The lack of them, and what it means for his campaign's viability. The sheriff said he has to turn down certain donations because he's a police officer. "When you're beholden to money, money controls you," Mindrick said. "And I am an honorable sheriff." Alignment with Trump. One theme of the race has been each candidate's attempt to pitch themselves as the most closely aligned to President Donald Trump. All three candidates at Tuesday's debate said that they would welcome Trump's endorsement, though the president endorsed Bailey in 2022. "I get a president who loves the police, who supports the police. He supports the military. Of course, I'm going to support that," Mindrick said, who was the only one of the three who did not identify something he disagrees with the president on. Heidner, who said he'd recently courted the president's son, Eric Trump, at his home, said he wishes Trump would support a, quote-unquote, path to citizenship without deporting them and having them come back. Dabrowski, a former international executive at Citibank, said he does not support the Trump's administration investing in private companies, saying the government should stay out of private businesses. The Bears Stadium. On what Illinois lawmakers should or shouldn't do to keep the Chicago Bears Stadium in Illinois, Dabrowski was the only candidate in the debate who said he does not support lawmakers giving the Bears power to negotiate property tax rates with local governments in Arlington Heights. "We should do all the public infrastructure that's fair and necessary, that the public benefits from support to a stadium, but we shouldn't give the Bears anything, and we certainly shouldn't give them breaks," Dabrowski said. Mindrick and Heidner said they support the legislation for the Bears. "This is not giving tax dollars away. These are giving tax dollars that are going to create as a partnership," Heidner said. Bringing down costs. Affordability was also a key topic of the debate. Dabrowski said property taxes should be capped at 1% of a property's value. He added, reducing the number of units of government in the state would help bring them down. Heidner said he would freeze all tax rates, including property taxes, if elected. However, property taxes are levied by local governments. Addressing rising utility prices is also part of Republicans' affordability agenda. Mindrick said he's glad Pritzker is embracing nuclear energy, but said it's not enough to bring prices down quickly. "That's 2033, and they're saying our crisis is going to hit in 2029, he said. "Well, guess what? We could just use our own coal right now, create jobs, create energy reductions by using our own materials that we have a plethora of in our state and export at a profit." Dabrowski said high energy prices aren't just a problem for residents. "Now, we're starting to turn away data centers. We're starting to turn away businesses," he said. Republicans will next debate on February the 26th on AM 560 radio in Chicago ahead of the March 17th primary. A crime in courts alert top story. McLean County jury weighs self-defense claim in Ellsworth woman's murder trial by Caitlin Klepek 19 hours ago. Bloomington. The case for Desiree Robertson lies in the hands of 12 jury members, who must determine if she feared for her life when she shot her husband or if she intended to kill him. The prosecution and the defense rested their cases Monday in the trial of the 42-year-old Ellsworth woman, who was accused of shooting her husband, 41-year-old Daniel J. Shelby, twice in the head on January the 10th of 2024. She faces four counts of first-degree murder following the fatal shooting. When Robertson took the stand in her own defense Monday, she said she, quote-unquote, felt like Shelby was going to kill her before she fired the fatal shots. Robertson said, before she shot her husband, he had been strangling her. She testified that once she was able to grab her gun, he looked at her enraged and said, "You gonna kill me? 'Cause I'm gonna kill you." Each of the two shots were independently fatal, pathologist Scott Denton testified, and because Shelby let go of Robertson before she pulled the trigger, the prosecution argues Robertson deliberately acted to end Shelby's life after she discovered him to be having an affair just days before he was killed. Robertson has pleaded not guilty to these charges. Rossi argues for guilty verdict. Assistant State's Attorney David Rossi argued Tuesday night that the jury should find Robertson guilty of first-degree murder. "You don't have to like the guy to return a guilty verdict," he said of Shelby during his closing argument. Domestic violence and affairs were discussed through the trial, as the defense argued Shelby'd had abused Robertson multiple times during their 24-year relationship, And although Rossi said he was not trying to minimize the abuse Robertson endured, he said he believed she was exaggerating the severity of the domestic violence. Rossi noted Robertson testified about several instances of domestic violence, but the prosecutor said most of them were not reported to police, did not have any witnesses, or had witnesses who denied they occurred. "You continuously see the narrative that she never seen him like that," Rossi said, referring Robertson's interviews and her testimony about Shelby's demeanor before the shooting. "But based off of her testimony yesterday, she definitely had." Rossi also argued there were contradictory statements and injuries in the domestic violence case filed against Shelby in May of 2022. He noted Robertson had said at different times Shelby had smacked, punched, and strangled her in that case, changing the description. In looking at the photographs of her injuries from May of 2022 and January of 2024, Rossi said he was not convinced the abuse was as severe as Robertson reported. He also said her story about what occurred on that January morning has changed dramatically since her initial interviews in 2024. Frizzle argues self-defense. Assistant public defender Mackenzie Frizzle argued Robertson was not able to get her story out with Detective Evan Hinkle, the officer who interviewed Robertson after the shooting. The McLean County Sheriff's Office took Robertson into custody as soon as deputies arrived on scene, before she had the opportunity to go to the hospital for treatment of her injuries, the defense attorney said during her closing argument. Frizzle suggested police did not thoroughly investigate, arguing Robertson's story is supported by the evidence presented even by the state. She noted Denton's autopsy findings indicated Shelby had a muscular build and that there were abrasions to the backs of his hands and forearms, consistent with Robertson's testimony that she had tried to pull his hands off of her. Frizzle argued Robertson's story was also supported by Denton's testimony on agonal breathing. She said the pathologist had said that Shelby could have had the abnormal gasping, irregular breaths that can occur when blood and fluid fill the lungs, as he found in the autopsy. Agonal breathing can cause the body to convulse after a lethal shot, which Frizzle argued means Robertson was being honest when she described seeing Shelby still moving after the first shot and being unsure if she had hit him. "He just learned his wife again meddled," Frizzle said, citing a text Shelby had sent to his girlfriend before his death that read, "I'll kill Robertson if she gets in the way." She argued he intended to keep that promise when he decided to strangle his wife. Robertson knew Shelby possessed guns and kept one under the mattress, which is in the direction he was moving before she fired, Frizzle said. The state has overlooked that she was with the first victim in this matter, Robertson's attorney said. Conflicting stories and unanswered questions. Rossi questioned the discovery of Shelby's gun and pointed to Robertson's initial interview, during which she made no reference to Shelby owning a firearm or past domestic violence, and she reported she did not think he would have killed her. He argued Robertson had reached her final straw when she learned about Shelby's affair, citing text messages in which she told her husband she wouldn't let him, quote-unquote, make a fool out of her again. Frizzle disagreed, noting the couple was already planning to separate, but Rossi said Robertson was still bitter, which led her to shoot him at close range. The question becomes, why was Daniel Shelby trying to kill his wife? Rossi asked. He won the marriage, job, new girlfriend headed out of town. The jury deliberates. Judge Don Knapp gave the jury its instructions Tuesday afternoon, and the jury deliberated for about 3.5 hours before breaking for the day. Deliberations continued Wednesday morning. Oh, how time flies. February 25th of 2026. 100 years ago on this date, and stilled and silent forever, is the great gun that once belched at the Allied forces. The siege gun arrived in Bloomington yesterday and was moved to the south side of the courthouse, where it will remain until the Legion determines where its permanent resting place will be. 75 years ago, February the 25th of 1951, William Monroe has sold the building housing his furniture store, 205 Broadway in Normal, to Eisner Grocery Company of Champaign, operators of the Piggly Wiggly stores. Piggly Wiggly officials indicated that it would be possible site for the new Normal store, now located at North and Broadway. 50 years ago, on February the 25th of 1976, the first hurdle was cleared Monday night for construction of a mall shopping center at Zary Plaza, southeast corner of U.S. 66 and Illinois 9. The Bloomington City Council approved rezoning of 40 acres of land, most of it farmland, to C1 local commercial. 25 years ago, on February the 25th of 2001. Spring is right around the corner, but it may seem like autumn for many Twin City residents who will find themselves with a rake in their hands. In case you haven't noticed, melting snow revealed lots of leaves around town. Besides the one in yards, gutters, and bushes, there are still some hanging from tree branches. Not a usual sight in mid-February. The non-native trees seem to be most affected, said Don Schmidt, a horticulturalist at Illinois State University. Schmidt said the dry summer forced many trees into early dormancy. 25 years ago, on February the 26th of 2001, Sesqui helped boost attendance at the McLean County Museum of History in 2000, setting a record. Downtown used to be the social center of the city for families. Last year, we were able to offer activities aimed at families that proved to be a lot of fun. We are definitely hoping to do the same this year, said museum director and volunteers Mary Ann Reynard. About 35,000 people visited the exhibits last year, including various traveling exhibits and off-site displays, and 4,229 people visited the museum's website. Museum staff believe most of the Sesqui guests were first-time visitors. 50 years ago, on February the 26th of 1976, plans for a retirement village that would include homes, apartments, and a nursing home were announced by Presbyterian Housing Program, PHP, an Indiana nonprofit organization, made the announcement at Second Presbyterian Church, who is providing the base of operations. 75 years ago, on February the 26th of 1951, a new high of $97,994 in premiums and membership fees is reported by State Farm Mutual Automobile Insurance Company. Premium writings were 12.76% greater than in 1949. At the year end, the company had more than 1,800,000 policies in force. 100 years ago, February 26 of 1926, an outline of Work City and the playground and recreation system that has proposed for Bloomington was given last night to representatives of important organizations. Well, thank you for listening, friends. This is Kayla Verhoeven with the first part of the Pantograph, and I'll be back soon to read the second part. Have a great day.